find out how much she's looking forward to the last night in just a few minutes, as she's promised to join me just as soon as she can in the interval, after packing away the Gariel Stradivari, which I think dates back to the early 1700s. Nicola was telling me that a previous happy player of it was Jamie Laredo. Now a music stand's been brought up. Nicola's back alone. She's talking to the orchestra's leader, Daniel Rainey. I think we're going to have an encore. Stand by.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for having me here. It's a phenomenal experience to play here. You are literally the best audience in the world. Not only my opinion. I would like to, as you can see, play a duet as an encore. This is really sort of a tribute to the orchestra. I think they are sounding so wonderful. They've been going through a tough time with cuts and all sorts of things in the last year, and they deserve all the support they can get. So I'd like to join to play with Daniel Rainey. Yes, just getting the start. Daniel Rainey, a piece from Scotland. It's by Willie Hunter, arranged by Paul Campbell. It's called Leaving Lerwick Harbour. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You just heard Leaving Lerwick Harbour, the tune by Willie Hunter, in a version for two violins dedicated to tonight's soloist Nicola Benedetti and Scottish fiddle player Kristen Harvey. We just heard Nicola duetting with Daniel Rainey, the leader of the National Youth Orchestra of Scotland. What a wonderful moment for him, sharing the spotlight here on the Royal Albert Hall stage with Nicola, and a huge embrace from her at the end of that performance. He won't forget that in a hurry, I'm sure. Back she comes. And yes, Nicola, it is the best audience in the world, isn't it? More applause for Daniel. And those cheers are for him as well. Nicola getting into his feet again to acknowledge his part in that beautiful duet. By the way, Daniel was the first violin you heard in that performance, just in case you were wondering. Nicola was telling me earlier that though she's not really been brought up in the Scottish fiddle playing tradition, she loves hearing it and playing with folk fiddlers whenever she gets the chance, but time is against her taking it as seriously as she'd like to. Well, you're listening to BBC Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, and we're live here at the Royal Albert Hall, where as part of this extraordinary celebration of youth and music, the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra has joined forces with the National Youth Orchestra of Scotland, and in the second half they'll be Waking a Monster, one of Scotland's most famous tourist attractions. It's the world premiere of Theo Musgrave's Proms Commission Loch Ness, a postcard from Scotland, plus two highly colourful romantic tone poems, Richard Strauss's Don Juan and Ottorino Respighi's The Pines of Rome. Now, I'm pretty sure some of our young musicians will be online and tweeting during the interval. If you want to join the conversations, we're at BBC Proms, and you can use the hashtag BBC Proms as well. Now, Nicola Benedetti is just parking her Strad backstage before she joins me, and joins us, I should say. My other guest is already here, cramming his tall frame into the very little space we have in our box. It's Dr. Christian Jessen, whose face you can probably picture if you've ever been drawn into the extraordinarily intimate world of his television programme, Embarrassing Bodies. Now, Christian, this is a fabulous showcase for the talents of these young musicians, isn't it?
It is such an incredible programme. And actually, that last piece, which I wasn't expecting, was so moving, how two young violinists held this entire hall completely spellbound. There wasn't a sound, there wasn't a cough, was there? It was wonderful.
Absolutely beautiful. That's a moment a lot of people are going to remember long after this concert's finished. Now, I gather you're an oboist. Are you still practicing?
A closet oboist. Do you know what? Every now and again, usually at Christmas and birthdays, it comes out of the cupboard and gets dusted off, and I find that I haven't got a decent reed and can't actually play, and in it goes again. But I was, yeah, and I sort of nearly did music instead of medicine.
It's funny how many people share those talents, isn't it? If you went down to that orchestra and asked, you'd probably find that quite a few of them were intending to go into medicine rather than music. You feel that in youth orchestras quite a bit.
And it's a horrible decision, because let's face it, music is so much more fun than medicine, isn't it? But I wasn't quite good enough for music. I may not be good enough for medicine, but that's what I chose anyway.
And what about your experiences of youth orchestras? Were they a sort of really formative part of your general education, never mind musical education?
Well, actually, without sounding big-headed, not just youth orchestras, but I remember my old director of music sort of shipping some of us out to replace ill members of genuine orchestras, like the Peterborough Philharmonic and things, when you needed a third oboist or whatever. We would be stuck in to do it. I remember being made to play recorders in a Purcell ode, I think it was, and being utterly panicked in a big professional concert in Peterborough Cathedral, and being utterly terrified, but at the same time so exhilarated at this idea of live performance, and that was really what I wanted to do.
And do you miss that adrenaline? Do you get some? You get some of it back on
well,
the shows
funny
you
enough,
present.
Yeah,
I'm
because
sure,
now I present live TV shows, so there's all that adrenaline as well, at having to get it right and not say rude words and, you know, look at the right camera and all the rest of it. So in a way, I get it, but I don't think what I'm doing is quite as glorious as performing at music. Put it that way.
And the discipline it takes, the disciplines that these young players have to absorb and have to show every time they take part in rehearsals and for a performance, something like this, these are things that do stay with you, aren't they?
Oh, it's incredible. Absolutely they do. Life skills, whatever they then go on to do, whether they stay in music or they go on to do something else, you know, those skills will absolutely serve them well, I think. And perhaps some of them will be medics. Mm. You know, it'd be interesting to find out, actually, now you've mentioned that.
We'll have to have a straw poll. Actually, we'll get them to text us.
Tweet.
Tweet. Absolutely. Now, you've presumably worked with quite a few musicians professionally. What sort of effect would you say that this kind of exposure to music and practicing music can actually have on somebody's life? How does it affect the way they...
I think music's incredibly important. I mean, we're learning more and more and more about the evils of stress, the damage that stress can do in life, and the various diseases and conditions that stress can exacerbate. And actually sort of getting away and sitting at a piano, for instance, for half an hour and strumming away, however bad you are, it doesn't matter, actually is enormously cathartic and relaxing. It's very similar, they say, to playing the piano and owning a dog have a similar effect to your stress. So why not do both, I'd say. But, you know, even I was never a great oboist, but just the joy that I got from sitting playing, and you have to focus, so you forget about everything else. And whatever else is troubling you in life, you can't think about it whilst you're performing, whilst you're playing to yourself. And I think that's a very important thing.
The same when you hear the problems.
Escapism.
It's a wonderful form of escapism, isn't it? You can just leave everything outside this building just behind
but
you and
you,
enter an extraordinary world.
As we sat there, I mean, I was, God knows where I was. I was miles away, you know. I didn't know what I was thinking of, but it's so transporting. And those Scotch sounders as well, the Scottish sounds, I should say, were just that last violin duet. Ah, just the images it conjures up. I don't want to say Brigadoon because that would be tacky, but...
Well, more from Dr. Jessen in just a moment. Now, every Sunday in our live intervals, Dr. Lucy Worsley's been ferreting out interesting places and things to see near the Royal Albert Hall. This evening, she could hardly be much closer. The Royal College of Music is just across the road. It's where I was yesterday with the young composers taking part in the Proms Inspire events and workshops. Now, the college has a collection of historical instruments, and Lucy went along to see one of the most fascinating in the collection with curator Jenny Nex.
We're in the keyboard gallery at the Royal College of Music, which is full of what Jenny, the curator here, calls her old ladies, which is a collection of harpsichords, pianos. Then over here we've got the world's oldest stringed keyboard instrument, which is called the clavicephalium. And exactly how old is it?
We think it dates from the late 15th century. It's not signed or dated, so we have to go by other indicators as to its age. But late 15th century kind of seems to fit all the evidence we have at the moment.
Now, it's a really unusual-looking instrument to me, but I can see that it's made of other things that I am familiar with. You've described it as a harp that stands upright on the table, and then has a little keyboard at the bottom.
Yes, the name clavicephalium literally means a harp with a keyboard, so that's one way of conceptualising it. Another way I like to think of it is an upright harpsichord, so it has the same plucking mechanism that you find in all members of the harpsichord family, but rather than the strings being the horizontal plane, like we're used to with harpsichords, they're vertically positioned right in front of your face when you're playing.
This is just perfect for people who live in flats, isn't it? It's
lovely,
a real space
yes,
saver.
Exactly. You don't need much floor space for one of these, and it's very light as well, so you could move it from one table to another, or so it would be an ideal modern instrument.
Why did they get taken over by the horizontal harpsichords then?
Well, both types have really coexisted right through history, but the horizontal ones seem to be the ones that have survived and the ones that we're most familiar with. I mean, even in the 18th and early 19th century, when the harpsichord was just before it fell out of use, really, you see adverts in newspapers for upright instruments. It's a space saver at any point in history, really. So, but why the upright harpsichord is less familiar than the upright piano is an interesting one to ponder. I'm not sure of the answer.
Now, let's look at it in detail. Inside its sort of string box, there's a thing that looks like the entrails of a human body. But
that's
it isn't, is it?
Interesting. It's a scene. We think that it was originally maybe a hillside scene. There may have been a crucifixion or a saint or some kind of figure at the top of the hill. There's a little tree that survives at the bottom and a little house. So it was probably quite a stunning visual object when it was brand new. Even the soundboard, the holes where the sound is free to come out of the soundbox, were filled with little ornamental windows and roses to make those look beautiful as well.
Now tell me how it was played, Jenny, because it's not quite like playing the piano, is it?
Well, we have the same layout of keyboard, so with the two and then the three accidentals in the same pattern that we're used to today, but the actual dimensions of each key are very different. They're slightly broader and also shorter from front to back, so that has an impact for how your hands fit over the keyboard. keyboard. And indeed, if you look at some of the written resources from the same sort of period, the fingerings they give you tend not to include the thumb. So, of course, that then changes the whole way you play, the whole way you phrase music. So today in our piano lessons, we're all taught to tuck our thumbs under very neatly and make everything very smooth. They had a very different approach then, and a lot of the scalic passages you see just with two fingers, so you're kind of walking down the keyboard in a way that I'm sure we've all experimented with, but our piano teachers would probably tell us off for.
Do you think that they played more slowly or just more jerkily? Did they not care about smoothness?
I think you can make smoothness by that, but they were, I think, happy to experiment. I think a lot of the way that we approach music today is to try and reproduce the best performance we've ever heard.
Yes.
And we want to play in that loud, that smooth, that fast manner that we're so used to. I think in the past there's been a lot more room for manoeuvre for musicians taking what's on the page as their starting point and then using the instruments, using their own knowledge, using their taste. Taste comes into music history a lot, to bring it to life, to make it their own.
So this is the replica of the Clavicepharium. And obviously the original doesn't work, but quite a lot of these instruments do look like people come in and play them, is that right?
Yes, that's right. We have a mixed approach here. It's a really difficult question for a museum of instruments, whether you play things or whether you don't play things. The problem with playing a musical instrument is you're wearing it out. And as a museum, you're in the business of not wearing things out, you're in the business of preserving them. So as you say, the Clavicepharium is very, very fragile, and if you put tension and strings on it, it will just crumble. So of course that's a bit of a no-brainer, we don't play that. But we do have a replica that we can then play to our heart's content without worrying about disfiguring historical material, and it gives our students a chance to work with it. We have composers come down and write for it, and the students, the keyboard students can play, and they can bring along their recorders and their singers to work with it as well. So it gives us a lot of opportunities to explore this wonderful music.
Lucy Worsley exploring the instruments in the collection at the Royal College of Music, and she'll be back again next week with another look at some of the fascinating local history around the Royal Albert Hall. You're listening to BBC Radio 3, the home of the BBC Proms. I'm Andrew McGregor, live at the Royal Albert Hall. Of Schoenberg's Gurrelieder, and that's the sound my guest in the interval of this evening's prom is looking forward to hearing next weekend, Dr. Christian Jessen. So what's attracting you to Gurrelieder? What is it that sort of fascinates you so much about
it? I've already got goosebumps. I mean, it's such an extraordinary over-the-top work. It's vast. It's enormous. It's just some of the descriptions, you know, you've got these cantering skeletal horsemen gallivanting around, and the end, this great sort of paean to the sun, is so exciting. I mean, it's on a massive scale. If you come and listen to it here, you'll be blown away by it.
It's a perfect place for it, isn't it? And also, it's an incredibly strong piece emotionally, isn't it? There's a lot of distress, a lot of pain. There's the murder of the king's mistress. And
there are some horrible bits, if I can say that in a nice way. And some of the most beautiful soprano arias, I think, you come straight out of a good opera. And of course it's Schoenberg before he went a bit funny, shall we say. It's Schoenberg that to me is still very, very accessible before he went too eternal.
It's the full-on romantic Schoenberg.
It's high romantic.
Where's the prom a week today, next Sunday evening, Jerzy Bielochlawik conducting Gurrelieder. I'm introducing the piece in the live Proms Plus event, so listen out for that from about 6:15 here on BBC Radio 3. Well, Christian, thanks for the moment. This evening's soloist Nicola Beneditti is joining us in just a moment. But this Proms celebration of youth and music is far from over after this Scottish prom. The National Youth Orchestra of Wales arrives for tomorrow's prom with their professional counterparts, and there's this. We're about to look ahead to Friday evening when the National Youth Jazz Orchestra returns for a late night prom.
I'm Anna, I'm 20, I play the French horn, and I'm a member of the National Youth Jazz Orchestra, which we refer to as NYJU.
I'm Rob Luft. I've held the guitar chair in NYJU for the previous 2 years, and I'm 18 years old.
What Nigo is basically a slightly expanded big band. There's about 22 people in it. There's an open Saturday morning rehearsal most weeks of the year, and you can literally just turn up to it. It's all very relaxed, very informal, very open. And I literally just one day decided it was something I'd like to do, turned up and got involved.
The band plays the entire spectrum of big band music. Whilst we will often feature composers such as Duke Ellington, Count Basie, we will also include contemporary big band music, often specially composed for the band.
The music that Nigel's playing at the prom is huge in breadth. There's sort of very standard stuff. We're doing Smellington, we're doing Rocking and Rhythm. We're also doing music written by people in the band. We've got a chart called The Change that's been written by Chris Whiter, who's the baritone sax player. We've also got a couple of charts from recent alumni in the band, Tom Stone, who's a fab tenor sax player, and Callum Al's chart on Caravan.
It's very exciting to be playing the music of Kenny Wheeler at the prom. We are playing the fifth movement of his Sweet Time Suite. It's from an album called Music for Large and Small Ensembles, which for me holds personal significance as one of my favourite pieces of music, as I was growing up. And it happens to be a feature for the guitarist on that album, John Abercrombie, who is also one of my favourite players. So it's very exciting to be able to step into that role.
It's been about 12 years now since Nigel last appeared at the proms. It's a fantastic venue, it's a fantastic audience, it's a fantastic atmosphere, and yeah, I think it's going to be really good for the orchestra to be back.
And you can hear Anna, Rob and the other members of the National Youth Jazz Orchestra in Friday's Late Prom, starting at 10:15 here in the Royal Albert Hall and live on BBC Radio 3. Now, Nicola Benedetti has made it. She's packed the violin away. She's leaning over into the box to talk to us. Nicola, at the Brook Scottish Fantasy with this fantastic youth orchestra as well. How was that for you?
Oh, that's always a hard question. Just after you've played, you're thinking a million things. But the atmosphere here is just absolutely brilliant. I enjoyed every minute of it. And it was great for me. I've sort of spent the week with the youth orchestra. So I didn't just meet up with them yesterday. I've been sort of working with them a lot. And it was just wonderful to share that moment with them. I really felt like we enjoyed it together, which was very, very memorable.
And you were the leader of the National Children's Orchestra,
yes,
weren't you?
Scotland,
at the age of nine, how important
was
that for you?
Eight? I'm being annoying.
I didn't think you were supposed to get in. You weren't supposed to be allowed in until you're nine.
Until you're nine. I know, I was too young, actually.
So that must have been a pretty important experience.
Oh, it was. It was frightening, but very, very important. I remember being really pushed to learn the repertoire for that course. It was quite taxing repertoire, and I was obviously so young. So, it made a big difference to my experiences in those early years.
And you're staying connected with music education. You're on the board of the Big Noise in Stirling, aren't you, I think? Is it the Scottish offshoot of Venezuela's El Sistema?
Yes.
And I don't think people always realise just quite how intensively the children have to work as part of that programme.
Nobody realises until you go through it yourself. I mean, well, I think anyone who started an instrument and stopped will tell you that the reason they stop is because they're not willing to put in those hours every day. And but that's really the message that we're trying to get really instated in Raplock, is that they have to put in the hours, otherwise they won't improve. And if they don't improve, then the identity and their sound isn't there, and the confidence isn't going to develop, which is what why they're doing it.
And it does, and it works really quickly as well, doesn't it? It's already making quite an impact in Scotland.
It's made a huge impact, yes.
Now, this isn't the last we'll hear from you at the proms this season. You're back with your trio for proms chamber music, Bach, Brahms and Korngold at Cadogan Hall. But you must tell us about the last night of the proms. You're playing the Brook. First violin concerto, Moorbrook, the other one.
The other one, the slightly more famous one. Roger Wright actually just told me it's been 100 years since this piece has been played at the proms. Not
really,
Brook
the Scottish
concerto,
Fantasy.
But the Scottish Fantasy, yes. I'm honoured to be the first.
Did he tell you afterwards rather than before?
He did tell me that afterwards. Thank you, Roger. I'm very glad he told me afterwards. But Brook Concerto, I'm sure, is performed here every single year. I mean, it's just such a popular work, and it's an honour to be asked to play it last night, and an honour to be asked to play that piece.
And have you chosen your dress yet?
No, I'm not even nearly there. And I have about three dresses at the moment, so I'm going to be on the third by the last night.
And both of you, what about the standard of youth orchestras these days? Because, you know, we've all played in them. It just seems to be going up and up and up, doesn't it?
Well, I was just noticing how young they were looking. I was looking at some of the horn players in the corner, and they're extraordinarily young, and yet so... They have so much conviction and calm.
And
I would have been a little terrified wreck if I was doing it. And the commitment, brilliant, I think. And we were just saying, you know, that's going to last them for life. And it's a wonderful thing.
Oh, absolutely.
Thing.
This experience for them, I think they will remember forever. And the whole experience of the dedication they're learning throughout the week of work is, something that develops you. It makes you grow.
Is it more fun playing with a youth orchestra?
Oh.
Than with a stuffy old big boys orchestra?
I would say yes. I'm sorry to any professional orchestra out there, but yes.
Do so.
You'll never work again.
No, exactly. I'm not. That's all my invitations cancelled. But no, they are. This orchestra, any other youth orchestra I've ever played with, there is an enthusiasm there, and I have to say that each and every one of them, they have been the loveliest group of teenagers, and committed and focused and dedicated. And I mean, like I was saying before the encore, they've had a lot of cuts to their funding, and it's an organisation that deserves to be supported hugely. It gives the children so much. Gives the Absolutely. I shouldn't say children, the students so much.
Can I ask you, did you pass around your Stradivarius and let them all have a go?
I let one of them hold it when I had to put my hair up in the first rehearsal, and they were all like, not me.
I'm really disappointed you didn't bring it. I wanted to sniff the varnish of a Stradivarius. I've never touched one.
It is a beautiful instrument.
The sound is incredible.
I took quite a close look at it a little earlier. It's a gorgeous,
it is a great,
beautiful
great
varnish, isn't it?
Yes, I'm very, very fortunate.
Well, look, it's lovely to have you both here. Nicola Benedetti and Dr. Christian Jessen, thanks so much for joining me. I hope we've left you with enough time to find your way back to your seat without being approached by someone auditioning for your television programme.
I've got out of it quite well by being here in the interval, because it would have happened by now, I assure you.
It's an occupational hazard for you, isn't it?
It is. They ask me things about bits. There we go. My mother's very proud.
I won't be doing that.
You're quite sure? You've got a wonderful opportunity here.
No, definitely not on the radio.
Now, we're looking forward to hearing you playing Korngold, Bach and Brahms with the trio. We must mention, you've got the Korngold Violin Concerto coming out on disc, haven't you?
I do, in September. Yes, that's in September. I recorded that violin concerto, both the Korngold arias that we'll be playing in the chamber prom, and everything else on the disc is music either written for or inspired by film. Or used in film, so it's a real sort of concept album based around Korngold, Korngold's beliefs, his story, his eclectic music, his ability to take a great piece of music in many different forms. So it's very, very exciting. Oh, I've got competition now.
Absolutely, we're just going to find out what the fundraising's reached this time. But Nicola, thanks very much indeed. For joining us
Thank
this evening.
Thank you so much.
Go back and rescue the Strad. I'm sure
I
you've got
will.
At least three
yes.
people guarding it for you from the orchestra.
Thank you very much.
And Dr. Christian Jessen, thanks very much for spending some time with us as well.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, you're listening to BBC Radio 3, the home of the BBC Proms. Andrew McGregor live here at the Royal Albert Hall for this season's celebration of youth and music from all corners of the UK. We've had the Ulster Youth Orchestra, the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain, hundreds of young voices in this afternoon's choral celebration. This evening, it's the National Youth Orchestra of Scotland sitting in with their professional peers from the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra and its chief conductor, Donald Runicles. Now, before the interval, we heard the youngsters on their own in Brooke's Scottish Fantasy with Nicola. And next, it's the turn of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra to regale us with the amorous adventures of Richard Strauss's Don Juan before the orchestras join forces again for tonight's world premiere and a glimpse of one of Scotland's most famous and long-lived residents, Nessie. The Loch Ness Monster in Thea Musgrave's Postcard from Scotland. And the march of Roman soldiers along the Appian Way should make for a spectacular ending. Respighi's The Pines of Rome. Well, also conceived in Italy was Richard Strauss's first fully formed orchestral masterpiece, Don Juan, literature's Don Juan or Mozart's Don Giovanni. Strauss was just 24 years old, head over heels in love with the singer he was later to marry, when he noted down in Italy the first ideas for this new tone poem, based on Nikolaus Lenau's version of the exploits of the legendary lover. Well, after a virile introduction, Strauss shows us two love scenes from the Don's life, the second distinctly more tender than the first, before our hero encounters a fiesta. He has a close encounter with death before his idealism leads him into a duel and his life is ended with the thrust of a rapier. Strauss put a quotation from Lenard's dramatic verse at the top of the score. The fuel is all consumed and the hearth is cold and dark. Well, the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra fully reassembled back on stage here with leader David Adams. An expectant hush falling over the audience in the Albert Hall. And here comes Donald Runnicles to conduct the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra in Richard Strauss's tone poem, Don Juan.
Thank you.
The Thrust of a Rapier, ending the life of Richard Strauss's Don Juan. And it was a huge success for the young Strauss when, in his mid-20s, he conducted the first performance in Weimar in 1889, impressing the critics with the colour, confidence and sheer flamboyance of his writing. And you just heard it brought colourfully to life by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Donald Runicles. And they're about to be joined by members of the National Youth Orchestra of Scotland once again for this evening's world premiere. And they brought with them Loch Ness, a postcard from Scotland. It's Scottish-born composer Thea Musgrave's Proms Commission, and she's crossed the Atlantic from her home in America to hear it for herself. I asked Thea to introduce us to what we're about to hear.
The piece starts in E-flat, and Loch Ness is very deep, so it starts with deep sounds, and Nessie, our monster, the tuba solo, is fast asleep and begins slowly to stir. Gradually, we begin to see hints of the sunrise, and then about 3-4 minutes in, Nessie comes to the surface and stands up, and at that point, we hear the sun and the trumpets come in. Unfortunately, the sun begins to sink rather quickly, so Nessie is a bit annoyed, but nevertheless, after a cadenza, there's a big splash, and Nessie sinks down back into E-flat. And while the sun is up, we have heard a Scottish tune. And now that Nessie is back down, Nessie remembers the tune, but instead of playing it in A major, now plays it in E-flat, because E-flat is the bottom of the loch. The moon shines, and there's a ripple across the water, and all is well.
Thea Musgrave telling me what's in store for us in her new piece, Loch Ness, a Postcard from Scotland. And taking the part of Nessie is the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra's principal tuba player, Ben Thompson. And there's a certain amount of simple choreography written into Thea's score. The soloist is instructed to stand at the point where Nessie's head emerges from the water, so perhaps, listening at home, you might want to imagine one of those famous grainy images that may or may not be photos of the Loch Ness monster, maybe the most recent one that emerged in the newspapers this weekend. Well, Thea was telling me earlier about how the piece actually came about, the way she didn't know quite where to start when the BBC's Proms Commission arrived, and she needed an idea, she told me. So she told her husband, Peter Mark, who's a conductor, that she wanted him to think of a title as inspiration. And she says it took him about 5 seconds to come up with Loch Ness, and she still doesn't know what suggested it to him. And we were having animated discussions backstage about Nessie's gender. Thea was telling me she's certain the monster is male, although her publisher disagrees. And here to conduct the first performance of Thea Musgrave's Loch Ness, a Postcard from Scotland, is Donald Runicles. A cool moon rises, a light breeze ruffles the surface of the waters, and all is at peace as Nessie returns to slumber in the depths, humming that newly acquired Scottish tune. You've just heard the world premiere here at the BBC Proms of Theo Musgrave's Loch Ness, a postcard from Scotland. And playing the part of the fabled monster was principal tuba player Ben Thompson, who I have to say handled the choreography very well, surfacing with a splash and disappearing below amidst those pizzicato strings. And Thea Musgrave is in the audience tonight. She's just being picked out by a spotlight on the far side of the hall from where I'm sitting, waving the Donald Ronicles and showing her thanks to the members of the combined forces of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra and National Youth Orchestra of Scotland after travelling all the way over from America to hear that first performance of her new piece here at the Proms. She was delighted to see the new Loch Ness monster photos that emerged in the press yesterday when I showed them to her. She's taking one of them back as a souvenir. Fantastic timing. I must have a word with the Proms publicity team. I have no idea how they managed to arrange it. Well, as we head for the grand finale of this evening's Prom, there's much stage rearrangement to do to accommodate the massive orchestra needed for a work by one of Max Bruch's students, Otterina Respighi's Pines of Rome. So I do have a moment or two to remind you that if you've missed any of this evening's concert, or if you want to hear any of it again, it'll be available to listen to online, like all the proms, for the next 7 days. Just go to the proms website or the Radio 3 homepage. And if you want to join the Twitterati around this evening's prom, we're at BBC Proms, and you can use the hashtag BBC Proms. I bet there's an awful lot of chatter being generated by our young Scottish musicians, not just the ones on stage, but their friends and supporters as well, many of whom were queuing around the hall waiting to meet players or parents earlier today. Tremendous support from them for all of our visitor youth orchestras this weekend, actually, and it's an amazing experience for them, not just to be on stage in the Royal Albert Hall playing in a prom, but sitting alongside their professional colleagues in the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, as I found out from two of our young players earlier today, violinist Jessica and trombonist Ewan.
I was sitting when rehearsing and I thought, I don't imagine that any of my teachers would have ever thought that I'd be sitting here, you know. So it's surreal, but in a positive sort of way.
Yeah, it's just amazing because the proms is such a prestigious event. It's so big for Britain, and you watch it on TV every year and you hear it on the radio, and then you suddenly, you're part of it.
And playing alongside the members of the BBC Orchestra as well, what's been the best bit about that for you two?
I think, well, for me personally, I'm sitting beside Simon Johnson, who's the first trombone player. He's absolutely fantastic player, and just by watching them, you can learn so much.
I'm lucky enough to sit next to the leader, so it's fantastic. You see how sections bond, and they work so efficiently as well, which is something that youngsters really benefit from learning.
And Donald Ronicles as well, how's he been working with the youth orchestra?
What I found was really nice that he treats us exactly the same as he treats the professionals, and it's so refreshing. It sort of makes you feel better and play better.
Let's talk about the sound of the Respighi, because just sitting listening to that up in the hall there, it's a phenomenal sound. How does it feel on stage?
As a brass player, definitely. Yeah, you sometimes wonder if you're deafening people slightly, but it's phenomenal to play.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's quite overpowering, but it's just so exciting the way it builds up and up, and you sort of feel everyone smiling and sort of together as a team around you, and there's sort of no other feeling like it, really. You just don't want it to stop.
You and Jessica from the National Youth Orchestra of Scotland, looking forward to unleashing the last item on this evening's programme, Respighi's Colourful Guide to the Pines of Rome. So for this symphonic poem, Respighi takes us to four favourite places around Rome and provides his own descriptions of what we're about to hear. First, children at play in the pine groves of the Villa Borghese, dancing in circles, playing soldiers, marching and fighting. Next, we're shown the pines casting shadows near the entrance to the catacombs, and from the depths comes the sound of mournful psalm singing, Gregorian chant floating through the air and mysteriously disappearing. Respighi's third scene is a nocturne. We see the pines of the Ianiculum Hill outlined in the clear light of the full moon while a nightingale sings, and as the birdsong fades into a misty dawn, there's the distant tramp of the marching feet on the Via Appia, a vision of bygone glories on the great military highway of ancient Rome as a mighty army bursts forth under the blazing morning sun. It's a fabulous moment for the brass percussion and the Royal Albert Hall's grand organ, which has been warming up ever since it was switched on during the interval. So here's conductor Donald Ronicles to whisk us to Respighi's Rome with the combined forces of the National Youth Orchestra of Scotland and the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra.